Hello and welcome back to Over My Dead Pod. I'm Kylie Caldwell.
This is Kate Carter.
And it's just the two of us.
It's just us, ladies and gents.
For the audio listeners, we are recording on St. Patrick's Day, so of course we're wearing green and we look very cute in green.
I didn't want to get pinched. Kylie, green's our color, to be honest.
We look good in green.
We do. Dark hair.
We're not Irish, but we are today.
Yep. Drink up.
Not to be a Debbie Downer, but I have a really sad story for today.
Is it related to St. Patty's Day?
It is not.
That would have been, I'm just saying, that would have been good.
Today's story is the Irish potato famine.
I'm sorry. What?
I'm just kidding.
Oh, I totally woke up this morning and did not know it was St. Patrick's Day. I don't leave the house and I have a child. So I just feel like she's not in school yet. So like I had no idea that it was today. And I went to the gym this morning and I walk in, every single person's wearing green, like the St. Patty's green, you know, like the bright color. And thank God I had on like these blue aqua green shorts that I'm wearing right now. And I didn't, like, nobody said anything to me. And I was like, oh,
I have not left the house today and I don't plan to, but I'm still supporting.
yeah. And it's Guinness. You have a Guinness shirt on. So it's like meant to be.
Meant to be, might have a couple later. We'll see.
Yeah. Oh, I would love one. Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead. What you got for us today?
Okay. So this one I heard a few years ago completely destroyed me. It is something like straight out of a Law and Order SVU episode.
It's gonna be good then.
It's good, but it's fucked up. And
All right.
unfortunately, it is real. So I'm going to tell you all about the story of Casey Woody, a 13-year-old girl whose story went on to become the first well-documented case of a victim being groomed, abducted, and murdered from the internet.
I love a good child case, Kylie. Love
Trigger warning.
them. Yeah.
All of them.
Trigger warning for all of our episodes, but especially anything that has to do with kids.
Especially. All right, so we'll get started. Casey Renee Woody was born on October 17th, 1989, in Little Rock, Arkansas. This whole story is in Arkansas. It's a shame Holly's not here. This case was probably on her list. She's an Arkansas girl.
Yeah.
So Casey was raised in a very rural area in Holland, Arkansas, which is about 45 minutes north of Little Rock. The town is super tiny. In the latest census, there were only 500 people.
Oh, which is like, I feel like a lot of Arkansas. Yeah. Imagine 500 people in your community. You know every single person.
And you know everyone's
And you
business.
know their business. Yep.
And they know yours.
Unfortunately.
So, as you can imagine, this town is super remote. You can go miles without seeing a neighbor. The landline calls were often billed as long distance, even if you were calling a phone number in the same county, which is crazy. So in Casey's family, you have her dad, Rick, who was a police officer, her mom, Christy, and she had two older brothers, Austin and Tim. So the family had already been through a lot before this main story starts. In June of 1997, the family was headed home after one of Tim's baseball games when a tragic accident occurred. A loose horse had run out in front of the family car and struck the mom, Christy, through the windshield and hit her in the passenger seat.
A horse?
A loose horse.
Can you even imagine?
Unfortunately, Christy died from her injuries. Rick, who was driving, also suffered a couple of broken bones, but luckily, all the kids in the back seat were okay. This obviously was very traumatic for the family, not only to witness, but to also deal with. Casey was only 7 at the time, and everyone knows our moms are the glue of the family. But the Woody family stayed close and did their best to just be happy. So at the time of this story, Casey was living with her dad, Rick, older brother, Tim, and Tim's college friend, Eric, in a rural home. Her aunt, which was her mom's sister, Teresa, also lived like right next door. So the family was still very, very close in every sense. Casey was a 7th grader at Greenbrier Middle School, and she was in the school band, choir, and was also in the gifted and talented programs. When she wasn't practicing her saxophone, Casey loved to write poetry, sing, and dance. And she did all this pretty independently. Like, her dad, Rick, wasn't bugging her to do her homework or practice her music. He worked a lot of overnight shifts and a lot of swing shifts, and he was out of the house a lot. Her brother and his friend, they're in college, they're also working. So she was kind of left home alone a lot, but she still would like get home from school, do her homework, cook cook herself dinner, do her own laundry. She's like a little independent adult.
Independent queen. Yep.
But Casey was also a typical preteen. She loved to hang out with her best friends, Sam and Jessica, gossiping about middle school drama and crushing on boys. It's also now, at this point, 2001. So what was little preteen's favorite pastime? Instant messaging on online chat rooms. The new hot big thing. So Casey's dad, Rick, allowed her to use the instant messengers online to keep in touch with her friends because, like I said earlier, the phone calls were being billed as like long distance and online messaging was free. So it made a lot more sense. Yes. So it is important to note at the time, like, this is all new. People and parents, I don't know if you could ever like really imagine at this time that there'd be creeps online. And like I said, Rick was working long hours, so he wasn't really monitoring Casey's internet usage. Like, he knew she was talking to people online, but he didn't really know the extent in the conversations. So,
yeah,
just want to put that out there. We're not blaming anybody. It was a different time. No one really understood. Anyway, so Casey signed up for an account on Yahoo Messenger, choosing the username Model Behavior 63. Favorite movie, Model Behavior, and her brother's football number. Casey stuck to chat rooms that were designed for other teenagers and regularly chatted in a group for Christian teens. Mm-hmm. It was in this chat room that on New Year's Eve 2001, Casey befriended a guy with the username Jazzman_DF. Jazzman said his name was Dave Fagan, a 17-year-old who was living in San Diego, California. After chatting a bit, Dave sent a photo of himself and he was every preteen girl's dream man, tall, long blonde hair, blue-eyed, tanned, surfer boy from California.
Sounds about right.
Casey also bonded with Dave over similar circumstances. She opened up about her mom's death, and wouldn't you know it, Dave's aunt had been in a bad car accident and had been in a coma ever since.
What?
Even more of a coincidence, his aunt was in a hospital in Arkansas.
What?
So the conversations kept going on for a couple months with Casey talking to Dave on the family computer almost every night after school. Casey was telling her best friends Sam and Jessica about Dave and she wanted them all to be friends with him too. So they added him on Yahoo as well. The online conversations eventually led to phone calls and Dave would also call her friends Sam and Jessica. Like, he was just part of the friend group now. Eventually, her friend Sam did start seeing some red flags. She noticed he didn't really talk like a teenager. He used terms like groovy and far out.
Oh.
So Sam did confront Casey about this. And she was like, hey, like, you might want to be careful. Like, hey, he could be a pedophile. And Casey was like, no, I think he's just from California. Obviously, a surfer dude in California is going to talk different than a kid in Arkansas. She kind of dismissed this, and this online friendship went on for months, and eventually Casey started opening up to her family about her internet friends. They didn't think much of it until the summer of 2002, when Casey mentioned to her dad that Dave was turning 18 soon. Her dad, Rick, was like, okay, now that's weird. I didn't realize he was that much older than you. I think you should stop talking to him. And of course, Casey did not listen, and she continued her friendship with Dave. One night in the fall of 2002, Casey was on the phone with Dave while Jessica was over spending the night. The two girls were just hanging out alone. The house was empty, like most nights. During this phone call with Dave, the girls started to hear some weird noises, like someone walking around outside the house, you know, like they could hear like sticks breaking and feet shuffling in the leaves. The girls locked themselves in Casey's room and pushed her dresser in front of the door, barricading themselves in. While doing this, the girls heard the floorboard in the kitchen squeak. Mind you, they're still on the phone with Dave during this, so Casey's telling him she's scared, she thinks someone broke into their house. Dave reassured her that no one was there, there's nothing to worry about, they're out in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas, nothing like that ever happens there. And shortly after this, the noises stopped and the phone call ended. So that was odd, but things kept carrying on. At some point in the same fall, Casey actually started talking to another boy she met in a chat room, a boy named Scott from Alpharetta, Georgia. He was 14, he played football and wrestled. Now, Casey found herself in a little love triangle, and she had to choose between Dave or Scott. She did eventually choose to start dating Scott. She did one of those, like, love compatibility tests.
Of course. Didn't we all at some point?
Every crush I ever had in middle school.
Absolutely.
So she broke the news to Dave, and he was like, okay, fine. Like, you choose Scott. He still wanted to be friends. Casey was like, okay, we're still friends. And then Dave also became friends with Scott.
Oh. So
Dave is wrapped up with, like, every single person Casey knows.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this brings us to December 3rd, 2002, which was a Tuesday. At school, Sam noticed that Casey had a photo of Scott hanging in her locker. It wasn't his little profile picture, and Sam asked where she got it from. Casey was like, oh, Scott mailed it to me. Sam, as we know, very ahead of internet safety for her age and her time, she was like, why are you giving out your address to people on the internet? He could be a pedophile. He could be a rapist. You don't know him. And Casey was like, it's fine. It's fine. And then the girls ended up getting into an argument. Typical preteen girl miscommunication. Apparently Sam said the photo of Scott was hot, but Casey thought she said fat. It turned into like this big drama, like the whole school was picking sides.
Oh.
You know how it goes.
Yeah.
But this fight caused Sam to go to the school counselor and tell her that Casey had been giving out her phone number and address to strangers online. I'm sure part of her was like, I'm gonna get back at her for this. But she's also still being a concerned friend that wasn't getting through to her. Casey had to meet with a counselor, and she told her that she only gave her number and address to people that she knew or that her dad had approved of. This, of course, was not true, but the counselor let it go. The counselor made the two girls make up, and afterwards, Casey asked Sam if she could spend the night at her house. Sam was confused. It was a school night. He never had sleepovers during the week, and her mom definitely was not going to be cool with that. After being turned down, Casey also asked her other friend Jessica and then another friend. They all thought it was odd, but said Casey didn't seem upset at them for saying no. Just said, bye, see you at school tomorrow. Casey headed home to an empty house. Her dad was working an overnight shift. Her brother Tim was at the college library doing some research. And his friend Eric was at his electrician's class. Casey's aunt next door was also out of town at her daughter's basketball game. Around 7 p.m., Casey's dad called her to check in, and she was having a normal night. She just had dinner, and she was now practicing her saxophone. After this, Casey logged into her instant messenger and started chatting with her boyfriend, Scott. At the same time, she was talking on the phone with Dave and relaying what he was saying to Scott. Dave explained that his aunt, the one in the coma, was going downhill, and he was driving to Arkansas to say his final goodbyes. Around 9:30 p.m., Casey suddenly stopped responding to Scott's messages. He kept trying to get a response, and he asked if she was okay. At 9:41 p.m., he only got back a weird one-word response. Yeah. Scott then called the house phone. No answer. He emailed Casey's best friend, Jessica. Also, no response. Around 10:15 p.m., Eric returned to the house, and it was quiet. No one was in the kitchen or living room, but Casey's bedroom door was closed, so he just assumed she had gone to bed. At 11:40 p.m., Casey's brother Tim got home, and he actually checked her room, but Casey was not in bed. Tim immediately called their dad, Rick, who raced home in his police cruiser. As soon as Rick stepped foot into his daughter's room, he knew something was wrong. Her reading glasses, which she used when she used the computer, were sitting there, but missing a lens. The computer was left unlocked, the chat window with Scott still open. The family's Yorkshire Terrier was also limping. Rick knew in his heart that something had happened. Casey had never snuck out, never went anywhere she wasn't supposed to. Like I said, super responsible. He did still call all of her friends and everyone around just to confirm. But after everyone said she wasn't at their house, Rick called for backup. Like every missing teenager, police assumed Casey had run off. Luckily, Rick was quickly able to change their mind. He said, hey, no, my daughter was abducted. He explained she was happy, no reason to leave. This had never happened before. Also, every single one of her coats and shoes were still in her room. It was at most 30 degrees and it was raining. So Casey did not walk out of the house without shoes or a coat. Pretty quickly, it was all hands on deck to find Casey. The Arkansas State Police, every single law enforcement agency in Faulkner County, and even the FBI showed up to the house and started searching. By 5:14 a.m., a level 2 Morgan Nick alert was issued. It's just another name for an Amber alert. Meanwhile, the FBI has seized the family computer and local police started talking to Casey's friends and classmates. Casey's relationships with Scott and Dave were apparent very quickly. Everyone knew about these guys. Police have the computer chats, etc. An FBI agent also found their names written down on pieces of paper in Casey's trash can in her room. So one paper said, Casey Renee Woody loves David Leslie Fagan. The other paper said, Casey Renee Woody loves Scott G. from when she did her little love compatibility test. So now police had two names to track down and two guys to talk to. Scott was tracked down pretty easily. Turns out Scott was exactly who he said he was. A 14-year-old boy in Alpharetta, Georgia. Who would have thought?
Really? Wow. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that.
The FBI down there visited his house to confirm and also confirmed that he was home the entire time. Completely cleared. Side note, his parents had no idea about his like online relationship with Casey or that he was talking to this Dave guy. So I'm sure that was a shock when the FBI showed up and found out your son's like embroiled in this like abduction scandal in Arkansas.
Yeah,
not imagine. The FBI did find out from Scott in their messages that Dave was driving to Arkansas from California. So now police just needed to find Dave. They started out by searching for California license plates, which I was like, that's a weird place to start. Needle in a haystack, California license plate in Arkansas. But it worked out. They found his car.
No, they didn't. They just, based off the plate?
Just a California license plate. They were just looking for a California license plate. They didn't know the number, what kind of car, the real name of this guy.
That shows you that there weren't many Californians in Arkansas.
Nope. So parked outside of a Motel 6, 20 minutes away in Conway, Arkansas, was a 1993 Buick Regal with a California license plate.
Conway, fun fact, Cameron went to school there for a little bit while we were in Arkansas, but it is a dry town.
And we know how I feel about that.
Yep. I didn't know those still existed until I lived in Arkansas.
Yeah, it's like half the towns in Arkansas are.
Yep.
So they find this car, and it's registered to a man named David Fuller. So very similar to the name police had, Dave Fagan. So who was David Fuller, aka Dave Fagan? You might have guessed it, but he was not an 18-year-old server boy. He was a 47-year-old registered sex offender. David was born and raised in Utah in a pretty strict and devout Mormon home. He left Salt Lake City for a bit during his first marriage, but returned once that ended. Back in the city, David met and married a woman named Sally while he was playing guitar at a local bar. He went on to join the Navy, and the family bounced around a bit. While he was stationed in Mississippi, him and Sally had a son, and later when he was stationed in Maryland, they welcomed a daughter. And so at the time of this story, his kids were 11 and 7, so really not that far off from Casey.
All of it's disgusting, but especially when they have kids that are like close in age.
So after leaving the Navy, the family settled in La Mesa, California, which is a little east of San Diego. This is when David became a problem. He developed really bad anger problems and mood swings. His wife, Sally, ended up filling out divorce paperwork, and they separated. Around the same time, CPS actually investigated David because they had gotten reports that he had been showering with his daughter.
Oh, reports. How do you get reports of that? Like, obviously the daughter told someone, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if it was like an anonymous tip or something.
Oh my God.
But they eventually concluded that the reports were false. But who knows with this guy? And also, who knows with CPS?
Also, how do you know, like, the reports are false? Like, what are they going to ask him if he did it? And he's going to say no.
So after this, he ended up moving into his own apartment, but things got worse. He was arrested and charged with spousal abuse after showing up at Sally's house, breaking down the door, and beating her up.
Oh.
He was also arrested for indecent exposure after he exposed his you-know-what to two little girls.
Okay, so he's a straight-up pedophile.
For sure.
A dick of a human.
Terrible man.
Yeah, great, wonderful.
And then, keeps going. Pretty soon after this, David was fired from his job as a used car salesman, which is already bad. Used car salesman.
Yeah.
Because he was watching pornography at his work desk, like on the work computer, and some reports say that it was child pornography.
Yeah, it ain't looking good, dude.
So this is David, and total creep. And for the audio listeners, he looks like a total creep. He's got the bald head, but with, like, the hair on the sides, the mustache, the whole thing. So back to the investigation, the police are like, okay, they find all this information out. They're like, this is definitely our guy. They talked to the staff at the Motel 6 who explained how odd he had been. David checked in on December 2nd and requested no maid service. He also complained to the staff that he wasn't able to connect to the internet in his room. Law enforcement searched his room at the motel and found a suitcase, still packed, a laptop, camo clothing, and rubber gloves. The bed was still made, and it didn't look like anyone had slept in it. Knowing David wasn't at the hotel and his car was there, police started to check with local car rental businesses to see if he may be in another vehicle, trying to further evade police. Turns out he did. The workers at the Enterprise in Conway also reported him coming in and acting weird. Apparently, while filling out the paperwork to rent a silver Dodge minivan, he repeatedly went out to smoke, making the whole ordeal take forever. Police were able to subpoena the car rental paperwork, and wouldn't you know, the phone number listed for David was the same phone number that matched calls to the Woody house. From this paperwork, police were also able to get David's credit card number, and records showed he had rented a storage unit down the street, so police headed there as soon as they found out. Casey hasn't even been missing 24 hours. Police are on it.
It's what we like to hear. Doesn't happen often.
No, but like, this is legit like a Law and Order SVU episode. Like, they got his name, they got his phone number, they got his credit card.
Right away.
We never hear that. So by now it's December 4th around 6 p.m. Conway Police Sergeant Jim Barrett arrived to storage unit 313 with two FBI agents in tow. The storage unit door was pulled down, but not locked, and the officers could hear a car engine running inside. Sergeant Barrett began to lift the door when all of a sudden a single gunshot rang out. The officers ran for cover and began to shout demands to those inside to come out with their hands up and surrender. But no one answered, and no one exited the unit. Not knowing if they were under fire, the officers waited for SWAT to show up and enter. Around 8:30, SWAT stormed inside and found David Fuller behind the van, deceased from a single gunshot wound to the head.
Of course.
So the van had been backed in. So if you open the door to the unit, you see the front of the van. He was behind it. With him was a 9mm pistol and cigarette butts littering the floor. David had been sitting in the van's back seats, which had been removed from the car. Sergeant Barrett looked into the van for Casey, and there she was. Casey was lying flat on her back where the seats used to be. She had been tied up by her wrist and ankles to the floor with chains. Casey had also been shot in the head and appeared to have been deceased for at least a few hours. Beside her head was a half-empty bottle of chloroform and a purple rag.
Take a little small break right there. Oh my god. I didn't think she was going to be right there. I thought it was still going to be a little bit of a manhunt.
It happened quick. It happened real quick. So a medical examiner confirmed that Casey had been raped. The examiner also said that it was likely Casey was unconscious from the chloroform from the time of her abduction up to her murder. So if it brings some peace, Casey probably wasn't aware of a single thing that happened to her that day. So the news of Casey's death sent shockwaves through her small town, from friends to strangers following along in the news. It all happened very, very quickly. Casey's best friends, Sam and Jessica, found out from the news when police held a press conference late that night. The two girls went out to the porch to get some air and space when it began to snow. A few days prior, Casey had told her friends she was hoping it would snow, and they took this as a sign that Casey was with her mom again.
Oh, that's real sad.
The sad one.
That's real sad.
While everyone is just starting the process of grieving, law enforcement were now tasked with figuring out what exactly happened. From the storage unit records, it showed that David had punched his access code at 10:15 p.m. on December 3rd, meaning he drove straight to the unit from the Woody house. The van had been parked there the entire time, and David had only left once, on foot, the next morning to go buy cigarettes and water at a nearby gas station. The radio in the van was turned on to the local news, leading police to believe he was listening in to the updates on the case, and he knew that police knew his name and they knew about the van. The FBI also went and searched his apartment in California. And when you know it, near his computer was a framed collage of Casey.
Oh my God, that's fucking weird.
On the desk were papers. He had a list of every single one of her friends, their phone numbers, and their addresses.
Dude, what a fucking creeper.
On the computer, David also, of course, had a bunch of photos of Casey and her friends saved. He also had saved a poem Casey shared with him, one she had written about her mom and the car accident. So throughout the investigating done by the FBI, they determined that David had actually visited Arkansas twice before he abducted Casey. On October 11th, he flew into Little Rock, rented a car, and checked into that same Motel 6 in Conway. That same weekend he was there, Casey was being crowned as the 7th grade queen at the local fall festival. Back in California, David bought a gun on November 2nd. 2 days later, he flew back to Little Rock, rented a car, and checked into that same motel again. On the 6th, he visited a storage unit and inquired into renting one large enough for vehicles, telling the manager he was in the business of buying used cars. Around this time was the same time that Casey and Jessica heard those strange noises in her house and thought someone had snuck in. The FBI believes this is plausible and that each time David went to Arkansas, he was planning on abducting Casey, but his plans were thwarted. After the second trip, David returned home to California and bought a few supplies from Home Depot. Duct tape, chains, and zip ties. He also bought chloroform from a chemical supply company. Why can people go buy chloroform?
Tell me a reason.
What are you doing with that other than...
Chloroform can be used to dissolve various substances like fats, oils, greases, rubber, waxes, and resin. I'm never gonna buy chloroform, but when I had my little candle business, that would have been good to like get wax out of shit, just pour a little chloroform on it. I would have like accidentally tried to do it on myself just to see what the effect was. You don't think that if you had that you would be like, let me test it out,
just like a little whiff,
just a little whiff, and if you knock out, you're in your own house. We don't condone this, you guys. I'm sorry.
We're not cutting that out, but that is a joke. Don't do that. So anyways, after this, David packed his car and drove to Arkansas this time. From what I can gather, it didn't look like he broke into the house. I know the door was regularly left unlocked. Rural area, people coming in and out. Totally normal for them to have the door unlocked. He also, like, he was on the phone with Casey at the time, so I don't know if he, like, lured her outside for a second. We don't know, and I guess we will never know. The FBI was also able to determine that David attempted to groom 3 other girls across the country around the same time, with all the girls being about the same age as Casey. There was a girl in Michigan that David had bought a plane ticket to California for. Luckily, the girl refused. There was a girl in Pennsylvania he talked to online using the same persona. Another girl in Texas had gotten flowers mailed to her from David. And when the FBI went and talked to her, she confirmed that she had never given him her address.
A full-on creep. I mean, in multiple ways, but like, this dude is crazy.
No words. So the FBI did enter David's DNA into the national database, thinking he's a serial predator, which, shocker. Wow. And they think he might have been involved in other cases, but as of today, his DNA has not returned as a match for any unsolved crimes. On December 9th, 2002, 13-year-old Casey Woody was buried beside her mother in Rosebud, Arkansas. The family and friends of Casey started the Casey Woody Foundation, a nonprofit that teaches parents and children about internet safety. Shortly after, the FBI's Innocent Images Task Force started wearing patches that showed a teddy bear sitting next to a computer, and on the computer it reads Casey Woody, 1989-2002. Casey's dad, Rick, was given one of these patches and he wears it on his leather motorcycle jacket. Every year for her birthday, Rick leaves yellow flowers, her favorite color, on her grave. He also leaves red roses on her mom Chrissy's grave every wedding anniversary. Casey's brother Tim is now a police officer in Arkansas, like his dad, and regularly gives talks about his sister's story and about internet safety. Before we wrap this up, I want to give a quick shout out. Kathy Fry did a really good web series on the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. It was a big source for this episode, so I recommend checking it out. I'll link it below.
That's a good one, by the way. Just the Gazette in general.
we're big fans. And that was this tragic story of Casey Renee Woody.
Snaps. Snaps for you, Kylie. I wonder, first off, if Holly had this on her list. But the only reason I don't think Holly had this on her list is that Holly tends to do older stories.
She does. And every time I go to edit hers, I have to find pictures for her stories. I'm like, oh, yeah. I got to pull it from the Smithsonian.
Yeah, the archives. Wow, that story is incredibly sad. I cannot believe how quick the police acted. I mean, good for them. That's what you want, obviously. But, and then how quick they were to find everything. That is nuts.
It was less than 24 hours, which is insane.
That is insane. That truly is. How sad is that too? 13 years old. It does make me feel a little bit better that she probably was knocked out. I mean, it's obviously not nice, but I hope that gives like some peace to her family.
Yeah, I think that's best case scenario, unfortunately. We have a lot to discuss for overtime. Want to jump in?
We do. We do. Let's do it. Kylie, if you've heard, which I assume you have, the Idaho case is currently on trial. The transcript was just released this weekend from the 911 call. And you know that here at Over My Dead Pod, we love a 911 call.
Love it.
And this one was interesting. I told Kylie, I texted her yesterday and I was like, you got to listen if you haven't heard already. I had to listen to it a few times because at first I wasn't like reading a transcript as I was hearing it. And mm-hmm. I, a few times was like, I don't know what's going on. I don't know who's talking right now. Cause it switches in between people. So I was like, I don't know who's talking, what's going on. So I think I listened to it like three or four times.
Yeah. After I listened to it, I had to go read the transcript. And then like you, I had to go to Reddit. For some more context. Cause I was very confused by the 911 call.
Yeah. Because it's not okay. When you think of a 911 call, you're like screaming, someone's dead. Okay. Also, this case, the kids were murdered. Like they were stabbed. So it is very evident of a crime scene in multiple rooms. And when you hear this 911 call, which we'll attach to this episode.
Yeah.
Cool. So when you hear this 911 call, it's not that. It's not a normal 911 call. It's everybody's calm, but kind of like confused. They aren't at the scene, or they weren't at first. And they just kept saying that like one of their roommates was unconscious. She was probably like drunk from the night before. She's unconscious and now she's not breathing. And you know, now there was a man in the house. It's a very weird 911 cause it's just, I get like in my head, they hadn't seen the crime scene.
Yeah. That's what I was confused about. Cause my first instinct was, okay, four people were stabbed and you're like, right. Oh, I think they're just, or one of them is just drunk and not waking up. I'm like, do you not see the blood? Like, are you not seeing the scene? Yeah. But from what I read,
Reddit helped a lot.
The girls on the call had not seen
no.
the body. It was the boyfriend, Hunter,
yeah.
who went in and then told them all to get out of the room once he saw what actually happened.
Yeah. So when from what I pieced together, because that we probably read the same Reddit articles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There was a few users who like, look, people, if you read through Reddit, sometimes you can go into a black hole, okay? And in this case, it was a good one. It was very informative. Mm-hmm. Internet sleuther, fantastic. But in this one, it's the 911 calls two girls, two roommates, and then one of the boyfriends. And they keep bouncing back and forth on the phone. And you're like, what is happening? And the girls basically in the middle of the night and in the morning had texted each other. Because you saw the text, right, Kylie?
Yeah.
They had been texting each other and they're like, what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. You know, one of our roommates isn't responding. Like, why is no one responding? Is everybody okay? So like they knew something was going on and they mm-hmm. even mentioned a guy in a ski mask. So like, obviously there was something was happening in the house. They didn't know to what extent. And then one roommate's on the main floor, one's in the basement and the one in the basement's like, come downstairs. So the two roommates got together in the basement and I guess went back to bed, fell asleep. Like I assume because they didn't call until the next morning. Right.
Yeah. And I saw a lot of things because I was quick to judge. I was like, how are you not freaking out? How are you not calling 911 like that night? Like, why are you so calm the next morning? But I think their brain just like blocked it out. You're like, oh, I'm overreacting. Like, this cannot be happening in my house.
Right. And it, so if you're texting one of your roommates who's upstairs in her bedroom and she's not responding and you're a college student, you're like, okay, she's either knocked out sleeping or maybe she's drunk, you know, and that's not why, you know, that's why she's not responding. There was a few reasons. The ski mask personally would have thrown me for a loop, but like, I could also see how maybe that was just some dude that was brought home, kind of, you know, like it could have been any kind of situation, but we're quick to judge from the outside. But so like the two roommates ended up texting each other, freaking out, ended up in the basement, called cops the next day. And they said that one of our roommates who's passed out, we think she was drunk last night. She's not waking up. Oh, and some man was in the house last night. So basically they were telling the person on the 911 call that the roommate was passed out, but they hadn't seen the roommate yet. And so then that's when the boyfriend goes in the room and is like, yeah, don't come in. She's unconscious and not breathing. And then the cops show up and the 911 call ends. But to this day at Over My Dead Pod, we just want to know how they didn't hear the multiple people getting stabbed. And the only thing I can think in my head, Kylie, and I don't know if you'll agree with this, is whoever killed them had to have like put a pillow over their heads or something like that, you know, like to muffle out any type of noise.
Yeah. And we don't know where they're stabbed. I mean,
or a quick
throat slash.
Yeah. To not make any noise come out.
That's what I'm thinking. But that takes a lot of skill to do that to four people very quickly.
To enter the rooms, because they were all in individual rooms too. So like, yeah, let's say they were all sleeping. You enter their room. If I'm in my own home and somebody opens my door, dear God, am I waking? You know, like they would not be able to jump me in my bed. I would put up a fight. And none, from what we know, none of these people put up a fight. It's very weird circumstances.
And then also, I mean, they were drinking. We don't know how drunk they were. I mean,
yeah.
If I go to bed drunk, I'm not getting up.
Yeah, you don't, you're a brick wall.
I'm a brick wall.
You're a brick wall. You don't listen to your alarms. I'm always on zone. I'm ready to fight anybody. I'm probably going to lose, but I'm going to fight my ass off.
Kate is always on fight or flight.
Yep, always. And it's always going to be fight, unfortunately, which is not the good. I don't know why my head tells me that, but it's not flight and it needs to switch to flight.
We don't run at Over My Dead Pod.
No. We should, but we don't. Anyways, yeah, so you guys listen to the 911 call. It's very interesting. We'll keep you guys updated with that case in general. It's a doozy, man, and very interesting to us. So
it is weird that all of this is getting released before the trial.
Right. We wanted to go to the court case, remember? And then we found out it was going to be closed and we got really pissed.
I'm still pissed.
Yeah, that would have been good. Someday we'll make it to one of them.
With that, thanks for tuning in to another quick little episode of Over My Dead Pod, and happy belated St. Patrick's Day.
Yep, yep.
And don't forget, like, subscribe, leave us five stars only, comment if you're on YouTube, and we'll see you next week with another case. Bye.
Bye.